Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Minutes after the Supreme Court released its decision overturning Roe v. Wade, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost filed a motion to drop the injunction against Ohio's six-week abortion ban. Hours later, a federal judge lifted the stay. Ohio abortion clinics remain open, but what's ahead? It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us this week, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
And Julie Carr-Smythe, Statehouse correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back.
Happy to be here and alive.
Alive. And she's been a drama queen all morning. And Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So no surprise that Attorney General Yost was so quick to dissolve the injunction. I wondered if it would be him or the governor first.
Oh, I think it was a mutual understanding between the Mike DeWine and Dave Yost. They had been talking for several weeks leading up to this that was their intent. They would go to court right away and get the stay lifted.
And it was very quickly.
Yeah, that was surprising because Judge Barrett down in U.S. District Court in Cincinnati, I think, had already closed up shop for the day, and then, boom, it came through. So. It kind of surprised us, I think, around, 6:15 or so?
Yeah.
On Friday? After drive.
Yeah.
Drive time.
The whole day was a flurry of, they filed, there was a chance for a response, a rebuttal, if you will, and then, it was done before the end of Friday.
Yeah, and I had talked to someone on their side of the issue who said, oh, yeah, we filed it, but it'll be, next week before they get to it, probably. They weren't even sure that Barrett was even in the office.
Right.
Friday was an absolute news-blasting fire hose.
I feel like every day's a fire hose, but go on. What was different about
Well, I mean, you had the Dobbs decision come out at a little after 10, and then, kind of all the reaction to it, and then the dramatic developments in U.S. District Court late in the day, the protests that developed at the State House.
Right.
The governor also signed 9 bills that day, and the Ohio Supreme Court made a ruling on a small redistricting matter. So it was like, boom, boom, boom.
And the governor asked people on both sides of the issue to remain civil, blah, blah, blah. Any reason why? Was there any suggestion that things would get uncivil?
We had heard that from a lot of people, especially those on the, who are anti-abortion. They were fearing for that. But there really hasn't been, any kind of big problem yet.
No, and I think there was an implication there because protests generally in the country have become very politicized. George Floyd protests, obviously, were emotional. They were mostly peaceful, but there was some ancillary criminal activity. And then, of course, we had the insurrection.
Oh, yeah.
And so people are trying to encourage people not to be violent, but they're also sort of questioning whether the left would act out.
And one thing to remember, during the past 20 years, abortion clinics have been firebombed. We've seen a lot of violence against abortion providers, so maybe that was in the back of their head.
Yeah,
as well.
Murders and assassinations, yeah.
Oh, I also think that there's been protests at pregnancy crisis centers as well. So I think that the governor is saying, be civil, be respectful, be kind. We recognize that there's really strong feelings on both sides of this issue. I think was also part of a concerted effort not to take a victory lap, and which could have inflamed people further. I don't know if telling people to be civil was necessarily the right message.
What do you mean? It came across as condescending, or
yeah? I mean, on Twitter, people were just flaming over that, and if you went, the protests, people were yelling and screaming about it. So it didn't go over well.
Sure,
but for that side.
But I would imagine there's not a lot that Mike DeWine could say that would go over well with the abortion rights activists, particularly. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Laura Bischoff of the politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Also with us, Julie Carr-Smythe, Statehouse correspondent for the Associated Press, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Yeah, we're talking about abortion rights in Ohio. how the Dobbs decision could play out, because now it's up to the states. Although it feels like it's been up to the states for a long time because of all the restrictions that have been put in place over the years since Casey, right, where they gave states the regulatory power to regulate how abortions are had in the different states. What does it mean, though, in practical terms for abortion clinics still open in Ohio?
Well, that's what we'll be sorting out today. So with the fetal heartbeat restriction in place, that law says that if once a fetal flutter, if you will,
yes,
is detected.
There's dispute about the
right, and the science makes that sooner and sooner and sooner. But once that is detected, then the abortion is, in most cases, not legal. So, you know, for the clinics right now, they're working on getting patients through who maybe fall prior to that time, and I guess just are going to be regrouping today.
Yeah, I think they're busy notifying patients who are beyond that that threshold.
And they're also, if they have a patient that was scheduled and can't get an abortion in Ohio, they're also referring them to places where they can get help to go out of state, even with resources if necessary.
The abortion funds are doing,
yes, to get some help. So there's a lot of movement going on right now. We don't know exactly how that's going to play out.
Governor DeWine has said that he wants to go as far as he can, as far as it. What does he have in mind? Just an all-out ban in Ohio, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is, I talked with Mike Ganadakis, the president of Ohio Right to Life, and, you know, he said that, you know, the plan is to enact a full ban, probably most likely during the lame duck session after the election. I think the lawmakers may or may not come back around September, but I would expect that they'll do it after the election.
I agree.
Why after the election? Because they'd be able to shoot through like grease lightning, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, they could get it through. That's probably the easiest time to get it through because people have already voted. It's the furthest time from the next election.
Okay.
So people, you know, something else could latch onto their memory in the next election. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we haven't yet had our legislative primaries, which are August 2nd.
Right.
And there are some candidates challenging incumbents who may be are a little stronger on this or a little are taking folks on this. And so they don't want to lose their primaries over it. So they'll wait until the safer time and also try to beat the Democrats then in November, because Democrats will most certainly be coming out with a, you know, vote for our entire slate, Ohio Supreme Court, legislature, et cetera, governor, because this is hoping that this is a key issue for their constituency.
Yeah, we saw that yesterday. The Ohio Democratic Party had organized a rally at the State House of people who were for abortion rights. And we saw the big top of the ticket there. We saw
Sherrod Brown.
Sherrod Brown was there. But we also saw Congressman Tim Ryan, who's running for U.S. Senate. We saw Nan Whaley, who's running against Governor DeWine. We saw a lot of Democrats who were up there, you know, saying vote for us, and they were basically saying the future of abortion is on the line, and if you don't vote for us, you're not going to have the option anymore.
I want to talk politics a little bit later because I think there's some huge political questions here,
right,
given the timing of all of this. But first, there are other, just to remind the listeners out there, that there are other abortion-related bans already in place in Ohio. The six-week so-called heartbeat bill goes on top of the ban on abortions regarding fetuses identified as having Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm. That's really the only one that has passed through court muster since around John Kasich's administration. There are six or seven abortion restrictions that have been on hold, including a D&E ban, and the fetal remains stuff isn't worked out
That's
yet
still
either.
In the, okay.
And then we had those restrictions on clinics that are actually still in court from, I think, 2016 or 2017. So, but the Down syndrome one is in place now. The fetal heartbeat one is too.
There are questions about or issue. You can't do telemedicine. You can't order. Is it
that one's been blocked too? I mean, I imagine they'll go through. The fetal heartbeat one was the furthest along, okay. So I think that they hopped on that first. But
yeah, but in a way, if you've got the fetal heartbeat, the 6-week abortion ban, if you've got that in place, it kind of makes the other ones moot or weak. So
there's also a longstanding requirement that parents and guardians be notified, be involved in when a minor receives an
abortion.
Right. There's a judicial bypass, but it's...
And an ultrasound requirement.
Yeah, and there's clinic rules about how close you need to be to
a doctor who can intervene, even though that's rarely needed.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's actually, it's sort of like a mosaic of restrictions that have come over the last 20, 30 years, you know, since Casey, really, since the Casey decision in 1992 that gave states the right to do restrictions as long as they didn't present an undue burden. And so Ohio Right to Life and the anti-abortion groups have been really successful in taking an incremental step-by-step approach.
And defining what an undue burden is to be something that actually, I mean, the whole point is it does restrict mm-hmm. abortion, so there is a burden.
Yeah, and as we see, if we see an outright ban, and as we see the more difficult pathway to abortion in Ohio, I think this is going to change to a freedom of speech issue. That's where this is going to go, because already we see some bills at the State House that are based on freedom of speech. We see cities like Lebanon trying to pass, well, they did pass a law, but it's kind of, it's muddy. But, it's based on a freedom of speech issue. And we've seen the ACLU come out on this issue saying you cannot go in and tell people what they can tell someone else. That's a freedom of speech. So that information that's being given out to people about their abortion options out of state, maybe abortion options with medication abortions or something else, that information, that's going to be the next thing that's going to be looked at very carefully by lawmakers.
Do you see Ohio as a state that would restrict over going women from leaving the state to get an abortion? Is Ohio that?
Well, we've heard Mike Anadakis at Right to Life say he doesn't believe it's going to go there because it wouldn't be constitutional to prevent people from doing whatever they want in another state. That's another state's business. Mm. But, I don't know. That'll certainly be tried.
I think there will be an effort for that. I mean, I don't know if it'll be successful, but there'll be an effort.
Senate President Matt Huffman lauded the ruling, no surprise there, and said that his members will evaluate what resources pregnancy centers and young families may need going forward. So there's nothing in place yet for the people who cannot get an abortion anymore in Ohio, right? I mean, they really haven't dealt with that. It's not something Republicans tend to be that interested in, generally.
Well, we heard Mike DeWine talk about that in his statement on Friday. He said that he's going to be working to, increase funding for early childhood development and maternal health. And he has, over his time as governor, has put more money into, various assistance for young families and young children.
But we know, as mothers, that childcare and getting paid a decent wage are
the diaper bill alone.
Yeah. We have a family friend whose childcare is $1 less per hour than her job. So, this is not an easy thing for people to afford.
Yeah, and Kelly Copeland with Pro-Choice Ohio came out Friday and she said, the Republicans are now talking about helping women who are in need like this. And she said, we can't even get, a paid maternity leave passed in this state. How are we going to, and I won't use her language, but how in the world can you talk about this? How can you have the gall to talk about this when you can't even back that effort? So, there's a lot of consensus out there among people who say it's just not enough. No matter what you do, you haven't done enough.
We are going to be hearing from Kelly Copeland and Mike Ganadakis next hour. Okay. Listeners, Mike Ganadakis of Ohio Right to Life and Kelly Copeland of Pro-Choice Ohio. We're going to take a quick break right now, and then we're going to get to the politics of this because it is an interesting question whether or not this motivates voters one way or the other. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Minutes after the Supreme Court released its decision overturning Roe v. Wade, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost filed a motion to drop the injunction against Ohio's six-week abortion ban. Hours later, a federal judge lifted that stay. That move likely played well with Yost's conservative Republican base, but what of the general election in November? In remarks last week, President Biden said the ball is in the voters' court now.
The only way we can secure a woman's right to choose, and the balance that existed, is for Congress to restore the protections of Roe v. Wade as federal law. No executive action from the president can do that. And if Congress, as it appears, lacks the votes to do that now, voters need to make their voices heard.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. So, you know, this is something of a badge of honor for Dave Yost at this juncture, but what is your sense about whether, you know, whether this will be a defining issue at the polls in November or even in the whatever you want to call them, the primaries in August?
Well, we know that 56% of Americans in some of the polls that were released over the weekend disagreed with the decision. They support abortion rights under certain circumstances. So all-out bans are not in public. The majority doesn't want that in this country. However, not all those people vote. The Democrats are going to have to really have a not only a fundraising effort, but some kind of a messaging that gets this across. Because what we've seen is that a lot of people are more interested in the economic issues, which are really hammering this administration, and they may not even vote on this issue.
You know, it's ironic, though, because we were just before we took the break, we're talking about the intersection of economics and abortion rights.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are struggling to make ends meet, and it's not just diapers and childcare that's the problem. It's, you know, they can't afford their college student loans and the, you know, the rent, or they can't, you know, afford just basic needs, basic health care, basic food for even older children. I mean, you've got to remember a lot of these women, if you look at the prototypes on the Ohio abortion report, a lot of these women are minority women who already have children at home. And that's really the prototype of who's getting an abortion in Ohio prior to this weekend. So, you know, there's that. There's also this thing. I went to an event. I covered the rally yesterday at the State House, and some people say it was like 3,000 people there. I don't know. I didn't count everyone, but a lot. There were a lot of people there. And I saw a lot of young faces. Young voters are hard to mobilize. Mm-hmm. And I was asking them, are you going to vote? And some of them said they hadn't, but this was making them, you know, think about voting. The other thing was that after that rally, I went over to a home in the Upper Arlington area. It was a private event. And Nan Whaley was there talking with folks. And you had even people who were neighbors and in that area, and they hadn't really gotten involved and they hadn't really done anything. But they said that this decision has made them get off the fence. They're going to donate. They're going to do more. They're going to vote. So I don't know. I mean, Nan Whaley is saying she thinks that this is a game changer. Is it? I don't know.
Well, I've read, you know, Laura Bischoff, the other side of the coin is, yes, some Republicans aren't super thrilled. It's probably more the ones that have to worry about getting people elected in November aren't super thrilled about the timing of this decision.
Right. The New York Times had a story over the weekend about how Republicans are quietly saying, like, well, we're really happy to see Roe get overturned. But at the same time, timing wasn't super great because everything was really going the GOP's way for sure.
Mm-hmm. It was a midterm election.
Midterm
so
election.
Baseline, it's better for the party out of power.
Right. And people have a really dim view of the economy right now, inflation, et cetera. So I think, I think the Dems were in position to get hammered in November. But abortion will change that calculus a little bit, I think, because it is an economic issue, and it is something that could mobilize younger voters. I mean, look, it's the 18 to 30, 35 group that's really impacted by this, and they're the ones who vote in lower numbers. And I think that it's probably going to motivate people more on the left than on the right, although certainly the right has been motivated by abortion politics for a long time.
Right, and the right is already baseline, turns out, much higher rate.
Right.
But there is also the risk that they're like, mission accomplished. You know, we did what we needed to do. You know, Trump was out this weekend taking a victory lap about the Supreme Court. And so there's a feeling like they have to keep their messaging going that this isn't over, because it's a motivator, a huge motivator on the right, and has been for these past 40 years, trying to get this overturned. So does that make people a little lackadaisical on the Republican side in the fall?
Yeah, and especially if the drum is being beat for issues with the economy that are not necessarily popular with Republicans. You start talking about mandatory paid maternity leave.
Right.
You start talking about some of these other things, and a lot of Republicans might look at that and say,
well, wait
yeah,
a minute.
I think we've done enough.
What? You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also with us, Laura Bischoff of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau and Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown spoke at the State House rally yesterday. His opponent in November, Republican J.D. Vance, has praised the ruling. But
Tim Ryan, you mean?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I gotcha.
Yeah. Sorry. Tim Ryan's opponent in November for the other Senate seat that's open. J.D. Vance praised the ruling but followed the suit of other Republicans who say that they'll continue to fight to ensure that every young mother has the resources they need to bring new life into the world. That's a quote. There isn't much of a track record in the Ohio General Assembly for doing that. Are they thinking this at the federal level?
It's a good question. Yeah. I mean, it has to be the new drumbeat, right? Is we're going to support young mothers and children. It's a nice idea, but some of the funding just institutionally in this country has been not to necessarily support, give enough support to those in poverty, those who need health care, those who need education help. And so, you know, that will be the question.
And when someone's thinking about, I can't afford a baby, they're thinking about more than just diapers and baby food. They're thinking about going forward, the trajectory of their life, what their earning potential is and all of that.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it can disrupt your education and your economic options and a lot more. I mean, the counter argument is that you can always place your baby for adoption, but then sometimes people don't want to make that choice.
Well, they less and less. It's not the stigma it once was, right. And so that's I'm sure people do, you know, choose adoption over abortion,
but we have
I'd be curious
a lot
to see how many that really affects.
Right, and there are a lot of kids out there right now awaiting adoption that can't find homes. So I think we need to remember that too, because I think, you know, that plays into this whole thing about adoption. People, you know, someone considering carrying a pregnancy through looks at that situation and thinks, wow, you know, I don't know what I want to do here.
I interviewed Gloria Steinem a number of years ago, and we talked about this issue, and she said that really the studies show that societies in which women are in charge of these decisions of when and how to bring a life into the world. They're better economically. They are, women know when they can afford a baby and what their relationship situation is and what their economic means are. And so, you know, they do have the ability to do that.
What Ohio races will be most affected by this ruling, if at all?
Well, the governor's race, I think, would be huge. And I also think that when you look at Tim Ryan's race running against J.D. Vance, I think that's going to be big because the U.S. Senate is going to be a battleground for anything that happens nationally. But I also think that you could look at some of these congressional races, and I don't think the state house is quite at the point of the congressional races only because of the redistricting that's been happening.
Right, but most of the action's going to happen at the state house
now. Yes, action will happen at the state house, and exactly that's what Nan Whaley was saying yesterday to the people at the event. She was saying, look, here's the thing. We have a gerrymandered system at the state house and in our, you know, legislative districts, and she's saying, I'm the backstop. You elect me, I'm the backstop so that the stuff can't get signed into law easily. And but as far as the state house and Senate seats, this has less of a play there, although it could.
You know, I hate to bring everything back to redistricting. It does fold back into redistricting. Right. The districts still give the GOP a pretty big advantage in Ohio, both on the congressional level and in the legislative races. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we heard that clip from President Biden saying that he thinks that there should be a federal law to enshrine the right to abortion. But I don't see that happening unless there's a major, major change and the Democrats win.
A lot bigger than they did last time around, even when they had a better chance.
Right, because even in the Senate, you know, they can't get past the filibuster rule.
Right.
So they'd have to pick up like another 9 seats and not lose any.
Hmm. Right.
Is the Democratic base disciplined enough to make a difference?
I mean, this is the question, because when you see the disconnect between public opinion polling and what happens in our government, that's the lack of turnout on the part of those who are on the Democratic or even the independent side. Mm-hmm. They tend to either not be motivated or have a lot more challenges to get to the polls. And now we have certain additional restrictions on voting, such as, you know, we have ID and that kind of thing. They are they like to say that we do have a pretty liberal early voting window here and the ability, but there's also going to be a lot of confusion in 2022 because of all the changes. And we just saw, as Laura mentioned earlier, over the weekend, you know, they changed up and added some more candidates to ballots. And so there are going to be two sets of primary ballots in August, and then people are probably going to think I already voted and not vote in November.
What happened with that, Laura? I was trying to.
So there were, I think, 6 Democrats who sued to say, like, hey, you guys changed the primary for legislative races from May to August, but you didn't change the filing deadline, and we should be allowed to get on the ballot. And then 2 Republicans also joined that suit. And the Supreme Court came out Friday on another split ruling that the Dems filed early enough that they should be added to the ballot, but the Republicans did not.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Even on principle, it mattered about when they filed.
Yes. But honestly, Friday was such a blur that
we may have to.
Sorry that I don't more details on this.
Well, I read it and I reread it and I triple read it, and I still was like having a hard time. Yeah, it was a busy day on Friday and all weekend long.
Yeah, and what I did see on the weekend was that Secretary of State Frank LaRose came out with a statement sort of condemning it and talking about how military and overseas voting is already underway, and so he will have to send a second ballot with those candidates' names on it.
Yeah, and then Allison Russo, the House Minority Leader, she blasted him, saying, "Yeah, this is from the guy who voted for you know, maps that were clearly unconstitutional, even after being told that they were unconstitutional." So, you know, tit for tat.
And the state legislature had the ability throughout that whole thing to change election dates and make things clearer. And they did give Frank LaRose some leeway to change filing deadlines and other administrative things as part of one bill. I'm not sure if that was specific to the May.
You know, and last week I was talking to some groups that are out there right now dealing with voter education on different issues, and they're saying that they're seeing voters just so confused. And I can understand why, because it's confusing. You know, we're sitting here, we cover this every day, and it's like, I need to check on
that. Well, I thought I'd never have to go through 2020 again, where we did, I think, a voter information hour almost once a week for couple months. Mm-hmm. And there was never one moment during any of those shows where the phones weren't, you know, the phone lines weren't lit up like a Christmas tree,
right,
because people had so many questions. And I foresee a similar situation this year.
Yeah, you're going to have to do that show a couple times, Ann.
Yeah, a lot more than a couple. We're going to take a break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Julie Carr-Smyth, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Joe, so there's abortion rights, and then what else when people go to the ballot in November?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, the Republicans will tell you that the things people are going to be thinking about when they go to the ballot, high gas prices, food costs going up, you know, they're going to think about the cost of living and the uncertainty of the economy and, you know, those sorts of issues. They think the pocketbook issues will be there. The Democrats, when you talk to them, they say that people are really angry about this abortion thing, that they're going to show up on that, that they're going to show up on guns, that they're going to have, you know, several issues that are going to bring them out versus, you know, a strict, you know, area.
And then the Supreme Court of the United States more broadly is now going to come into focus. Mm-hmm. We heard over the weekend Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about this push to add more justices to the court, because if we recall our history, you know, when Barack Obama was president, he had the opportunities to appoint and was blocked.
9 months before the election day.
And I think it was Merrick Garland, who's now the Attorney General, but they blocked him.
It was in February.
And then when the same opportunity came up with the exact same timing under Trump, they went for it. So there was some real hypocrisy there. And they have now got these three justices for a total.
Actually, it wasn't the same timing as I remember, because Justice Ginsburg died in the September
fall.
Or October sometime.
And they
really hurried up and got that appointment.
You mean it was even
more
rushed?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That would have been for Merrick Garland.
And it's not just the highest court. The federal bench is just, they hundreds of slots were filled during the Trump administration.
Absolutely. That was really what the conservative right wanted, and why they maybe put up with Donald Trump, who, you know, three times divorced and had other issues and that didn't really jive with their values, and but they really wanted the federal court to shift.
And this year, for the first time in Ohio, you're going to see the top court candidates have an R or a D next to their name. Now, the reason that the Republican-dominated state legislature wanted that was, you know, they said, well, this clarity where they stand, and also They also thought that that would benefit them. But if there is a huge wave, if the Democrats turn out to be right, and there is a wave of people coming out,
it's a roadmap for them as well.
It's nice for them, too.
I think the Ohio Supreme Court races are really interesting. Yeah. You know, you got Sharon Kennedy and Jennifer Bruner, who are current justices. Kennedy's a Republican, Bruner's a Democrat. They're going for Chief Justice to replace Maureen O'Connor, who, because of age limits, has to step down at the end of the year. And then you got two Republicans named Pat from Cincinnati, and they're the Republicans, Pat DeWine and Pat Fisher. They want to hang on to their seats, and they're being challenged by Marilyn Zayas against DeWine and Terry Jameson against Fisher. So it is a really interesting race there, and I think that the remnants of redistricting are going to, you know, kind of go before the court again.
And they're not only identifying their party affiliation, but they're moving it up the ballot, too. Supreme Court used to be down ballot. Mm-hmm. Aren't they moving its position on the ballot?
I don't know about that, but I do know that the party affiliation identifier applies to appellate judges and the Ohio Supreme Court races, not to like your local judge races.
But you do see a drop off usually in an election because people will vote the rest of the ticket and they get down to court and they're like,
I don't know who that is.
Right. And I mean, we saw this Trump effect in the courts in the redistricting where, you know, the state court had so many maps, so many rejections. But then when it got to the federal court, there was a 3-judge panel, and the 2 judges who were appointed by Trump wound up siding with the unconstitutional map for 1 year, for one election. So had the federal bench looked differently, we might have a different map.
You know, you asked at the outset about what other issues are going to be on the ballot. I do think abortion will be on the ballot. I think the economy... one thing that the right is probably breathing a sigh of relief about is that legal weed will not be on the ballot in Ohio. And I think between abortion and weed, that would have been like a double whammy in favor of the left.
Yet another issue that Republicans are out of step with the electorate on, majority.
I think it's something that would have motivated younger voters for sure.
Yeah. Laura, in other news, you wrote about a new law signed by Governor DeWine. It prohibits cities from imposing rent control, another anti-local control move.
Yeah, I talked to Kent Skerritt from the Ohio Municipal League and asked him if it was a home rule issue, and he said that they're looking at that. Basically, the law will block cities from moving forward on rent control. I think the only city that was really looking at that was the city of Columbus. In April, there was a group that was circulating petitions to put that on the ballot. So, you know, it's an issue in a lot of states as affordable housing becomes harder and harder to find.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the governor says they want to be more supportive of people who are considering, who might be pregnant. And I'm just wondering, rent is a huge proportion of anyone's budget now.
Yeah, and you see the price of rent in the big cities in Ohio has gone up pretty significantly in the last few years. And it, also there's, you know, younger Ohioans who can't really afford to buy a house in this. The housing market is really hot, and there's huge competition for anything that's in the realm of affordable.
Mm-hmm. And another local control issue that we're going to see in the fall is this non-citizen voting measure.
That's on the ballot, right?
It's made it to the ballot, right? And it would prohibit non-citizens from being allowed to vote at the local level. They're already prohibited at the federal and state level. So we had one village, Yellow Springs, that passed a charter amendment that would allow legal immigrants to often longstanding residents to vote just for, say, city council, school board, the things that they're involved
zoning,
in.
Blah, blah, blah.
And we've seen this in other cities too. In San Francisco, you can vote on school boards, in New York City. And the lawmaker said they wanted to sort of nip that in the bud and clarify that that's not an element of local control. They don't want cities to be able to do that.
Why don't they want cities to be able to do that?
Well,
I mean,
the position is that the franchise of voting is the ultimate the ultimate privilege of citizenship, and therefore you should be a citizen to vote. We've only had a federal restriction on non-citizen voting since 1996. So some of the folks I've been talking to about the history of this say, you know, we've often had the ability for non-citizens to vote at the local level, at least.
There's a whole bunch of ways in which the legislature has kind of eroded local control, particularly on gun restrictions. That's been one area. There was also a plastic bag ban bill that passed.
Yeah, and right. The puppy mills. Don't forget the puppy mills.
Yeah, so there's a bunch.
There's a whole bunch.
You know, another issue.
Traffic cameras.
Yep. Yeah, it's a. Actually, I did kind of a roundup story. It was rather long.
Yes, it was. I remember that. And it's really interesting because when I first came here 30 plus years ago to cover the General Assembly, they would kind of beat their breasts over the fact that it's a home rule state. And this was really important to particularly conservative Republican lawmakers from more rural areas. And now, nada. Or very little. I'm not quite sure what's left.
Because the rural towns and villages maybe aren't trying to do the more liberal things that the big cities are. So it becomes a city versus
state. It tends to be big cities that are the targets of these anti-home rules.
There is another issue that's going to be on the ballot, which is has to do with bail. There's a constitutional amendment that the lawmakers put on the November ballot. And what it would do is require judges to consider the nature of the crime and public safety when setting money bail. There was a decision in the DeBose case. It was a split decision from the Ohio Supreme Court, I think in January 2021?
Yes.
Or was it just this year? Maybe it was just this year.
Or just it was just here in December?
Recent decision. And it basically said that... money, you can't set excessive money bail. That's unconstitutional under the federal constitution and the state constitution, and that money bail can only be set to assure somebody to return to court.
That was what it was established for.
Right. And, you know, judges have the ability to hold a hearing to hold somebody pre-trial already, depending on the charge. But that requires holding a hearing, and the prosecutors weren't necessarily doing that, so they were asking for higher bonds. And the Supreme Court said, no way, not allowed. And the response from the Republicans, from Dave Yost and Mike DeWine, and the Republicans running for Ohio Supreme Court seats has been to support this constitutional amendment.
Let's shift gears just a little bit. Julie, Intel's massive chip manufacturing facility, or imagined or hoped for, in Central Ohio might be delayed due to a failure by Congress to pass the multi-billion-dollar CHIPS Act. What's going on there? Apparently they're still under construction, but they pushed back the big grand opening, whatever they call it, ribbon-cutting thing.
Yeah, I mean, from what I know... you know, the groundbreaking was symbolically important, at least. They are still working on this, but I think that the idea was to kind of put some pressure on Congress, get this promised funding, because we've got a lot going on here, and, you know, we're trying to bring a chip manufacturer back to these shores. And it's a point of pride, obviously, for both everyone from Sherrod Brown to Mike DeWine and everyone else, but... the CHIPS Act in Congress is stalled, so I think it was a pressure tactic.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about the CHIPS Act is we find that the Republicans and the Democrats are on the same page as far as the gist of the bill. So, it's getting bogged down with little things have been attached, that sort of stuff. That's the truth with so many bills.
That's what happens if something's going to make it through, then they start attaching.
But this is a lot of money on the line, you know? And so Intel's not willing to step out there and say, hey, we're going to put all these millions of dollars into this thing in Central Ohio if we don't have the help from the federal government to do it.
And how's the governor responded to all this?
Cautiously. he keeps saying, you know, the Intel deal is on. Don't worry. It's not like Intel's pulling out. He says that he's been talking with the head of Intel and that, they really are going to go through with what they've promised. But he said the thing is that they need to make the lawmakers at the federal level understand that this is important and the scope of this is important and that they need to get busy and pass it.
Huh. Testimony in the House committee studying the January 6th insurrection included that of that Georgia election worker and others who focused attention on the plight of all election workers in an era where trust for the system has been tested already. Julie, you wrote about that, and I was kind of interested in what your, you know, what kind of insights you gleaned because we have a big, complicated, confusing election coming up.
Yes, and what we've seen post-2020, and particularly threats from the former president and his allies, some directed by name to against local election workers, you've seen people with a lot of fatigue. We've seen departures from local election departments and boards, and so it is a problem ongoing as far as just people not wanting to do that very, very essential job for democracy.
You know, it requires about 35,000 poll workers to put on an election statewide in Ohio, and it is a very long day. My husband's been doing this for a long time, and it begins 6 a.m. and it doesn't end until 8 p.m. or so, and they only get paid like $10 an hour. And there's a lot of training that that's, you know, you have to do online and you know, practice makes perfect little sessions as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that the added pressure of just getting berated and attacked it makes it a lot less attractive.
And it's been, I mean, even some secretaries of state have received death threats. We've seen arrests of people who are sending just absolutely profanity-laced, scary messages on social media and an email to election boards at the state and local level. And one man has, you know, pleaded guilty to, you know, basically telling people your children should die and other
in
things
Ohio?
Like that. No, in another state.
Yeah.
But, I mean, these are, you know, I mean, it gets really ugly.
Yeah.
And it's because people believe the untrue allegations of election fraud that have been spread by Donald Trump.
Is there
others.
Any indication from the Ohio Secretary of State that it's affecting participation?
I do know that poll worker recruitment thing pops up every time you're on his website.
And he's trying to get, you know, people, they're still needing people for the August election, last I heard. So
the, you know, the poll recruiting thing started during COVID because, you know, the average age of the poll workers is pretty high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was concern that poll workers, the elderly, would be exposed and, you know, could be very, very problematic. In Ohio, there's a Democrat, you know, we have every polling location has a Democrat and a Republican. It is a very bipartisan system. And I think that people just don't understand that when there's all these attacks going on, that it's rigged and...
So we've got a couple minutes left. What are you guys looking for this week, Julie Kerr-Smythe?
Well, as we talked at the top of the hour, I'm going to be just trying to explain to readers exactly what the heartbeat bill does, how it functions, how it's impacting the clinics, and that'll probably be my priority today.
Yeah, and I'll be looking at those things, you know, looking at what's next for Ohio as far as life without Roe versus Wade, and also maybe looking for a little sleep.
You're busy this weekend, that's for sure.
Same. I mean, more on the impact of the Dobbs decision, more explanation about its impact and what comes next in Ohio.
And as far as one question I wanted to ask you guys, I forgot, was about the issue of birth control. Do you see Ohio General Assembly going in that direction, banning forms of birth control or not?
Maybe.
Interesting.
I don't know.
I mean, it depends on if they want to appear, you know, supportive of women or to find some kind of middle ground here. Or if it's going to be sort of the abstinence-only message all the way down.
Yeah, and it also depends, you know, like Plan B, which is not RU486. That's a different thing. You know, there's a lot of lawmakers out there who have come out against Plan B. And, you know, we know that some of these things, these pieces of legislation, if they were enacted, would have outlawed like IUDs, possibly birth control pills. So, I mean, it depends on where they go with it.
But I do think I spoke to someone this weekend who was talking about how these sorts of options are part of feeling okay about Roe being overturned. You know, if you've got the ability to have birth control and aftercare, then maybe that's okay.
That's it for now. Thanks to Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for your time today. And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.